It's a great honour to be giving the Slade Lectures this year, and for me a great pleasure also to come back to Oxford for both personal and professional reasons. For personal reasons, because my father was, at the beginning of his career, chaplain of Harford, and in retirement at the end of his career, chaplain of All Souls. And I was a boy at the Dragon School. For professional reasons, because the first day I came to study modern history here at St. Cat's, I opened up the examination decrees and saw that one could do a course in one's final year called Baudelaire and the Artists of His Time. And I decided there and then to do it, which I did, studying under Francis Haskell and T.J. Clarke. And in that way, I was launched on my career as an art historian, which a third of a century later sees me on this podium. So I better give you a lecture. But I can't, because I don't know how to dim the lights, because this is dark. Lights. Defining the dominant naturalism. Naturalism was the dominant aesthetic of late 19th century France. In painting, as in literature, it set the cultural tone, shaped and suited the mentalité of the mainstream, worked hand in hand with the political ideology of the Third Republic. And no wonder. Naturalist painting, descriptive, frank, direct, was a dynamic kind of art. Look at the canvases that won gold medals at the Great Exposition Universelle in 1889 and 1900. Émile Friant's All Saints' Day represents a snatched moment of something seen. The little girl in mid-step is just about to give the blind beggar a coin as her family follows behind on their way to the annual visit to the municipal cemetery. In Charles Cotet's The Farewells, all is still and meditative in the central panel of the final meal before the Breton fishermen set out to sea, and in the side panels of the men on their vessel and the women waiting on the cliffs. Both canvases on their day were held up as standing for the best in modern French painting. How different they are. The Friant encapsulating in its life-size figures a moment of experience, conjuring up the cold, making evident its class contrasts and the dutiful act of charity. And the Cotet using its equally large scale to quasi-ritual effect, its groups of figures silent in the gloomy light. Yet both are fundamentally naturalistic, describing the material world with attention to the physical actuality of bodies and textures. They are also both conscious of their different painterly artifices. All Saints' Day, with its cut-off figures and central void, the Farewells, with its almost symmetrical play with the triptych format. And there are other similarities. The idea of the family is pivotal, together with its inescapable dimensions of continuity and loss. Both have a religious resonance, Friant's in the depiction of an annual act of observance, Cotet's in its echo of a scene of the Last Supper. How surprising! Throughout the 1880s and 1890s, the Third Republic set out to wrest influence from the Catholic Church in a hard-fought struggle for determining influence over the national mind. And yet the two French paintings which won gold medals at successive Expositions Universelles and were purchased by the state for the national collections had religious associations. Dealing with such paintings, then, we have to cope with more than mere description. Contrived in their making and moving in their impact, modern in their forms of representation and rich in contradictions, these are complex works of art. Between 1880 and 1900, the span of these lectures, naturalist painting created a panorama, an encyclopedia of contemporary French life. Let's have a tour d'horizon and look at some polarities. We might begin in 1880 with Francis Tattegrain's Collector of Flotsam, life-size and emphatically filling the space immediately in front of us with her load of wreckage, sturdy presence, and surly unwillingness to make eye contact. And end, in 1901, with Ernest-Georges Bergès's visit to the factory after a soirée with the director. An equally arresting painting, this time setting prosperity and proprietorship within the grim realities of industrial production, with its startling conjunction of fan and furnace, satin and sweat, and its strange compositional combination of the statuesque and the precarious. Top and bottom of society then, and also industry and agriculture. Joseph Fortuné Leroy's Steelworks of Saint-Chamond of 1889 dwarfs the workers by the huge factory as they cast a gun for a battleship, while Léon Lhermitte's Market at Château Thierry, painted a decade earlier, embraces the mainly female shoppers in the placid town square. Descriptive in their representation, both paintings tackle aspects of the economy, alluding to the larger issues of France's still troubled status as a great power and anxieties about the depopulation of the countryside as people left for industrial work in the cities. The pictures, too, are explicit about place. Leroy's factory in the département of the Loire, Lhermitte's market there in the Aisne. Collectively, by accretion, such paintings built up that encyclopedia of France. And how different is Lhermitte's market to Camille Pissarro's market scenes, such as the Charcutière of 1883? Pissarro used some brighter colour and a more evident brushstroke, and here employed a close-up design, but both artists built their compositions around strongly drawn figures, describing different activities and detailing the nuances of class in rural communities. Impressionist painters, like Pissarro, were, one can argue, engaged in a form of naturalism, a need to be written in to its historical analysis. Let's look at one other polarity, this time in the work of a single artist. At the Salon of 1887, Henri Gervex exhibited Before the Operation, a group portrait of the celebrated surgeon Jules Payon and his team. A carefully staged account of medical practice and instruction, not failing to draw attention to surgical instruments of Payon's own devising, Before the Operation typifies naturalism's alliance with modern science. 4 years later, at the Société Nationale des Beaux-Arts, Gervex showed his ceiling for the Grand Salle des Fêtes at the Paris Hôtel de Ville. For the theme music, Gervex opted to counterpoint the here and now of a modern, naturalistic image of a singer on stage, seen across the heads of spectators and orchestra, with a vertiginous composition of musicians in 18th century costume set among allegorical figures, the whole creating a rather bizarre combination of Degas and Tiepolo. But with these two paintings, for different purposes, Gervex demonstrated naturalism's elasticity, how it could be adapted to depict the most contemporary in scientific medicine and allied with traditional forms of representation. You can already see, I hope, that there were many naturalisms. At its best, naturalist painting could be daring and varied, instructive, confrontational, grand, even meditative. And one of the things I want to do in these lectures is to show that at best, its qualities and complexities deserve better than art history often allows. Naturalist painting had two characteristics which I want to insist upon at the outset. First, as I've already hinted, it was flexible, adaptable to different subjects and purposes, accommodating to individual manners of painting within its broad compass of the descriptive. Second, it was modern. It depicted the here and now, of course, what could be seen, what was part of contemporary experience. But its modern character resided not merely in its descriptiveness, but also in the way in which the representation of the actual elided with broader ideological and philosophical understandings of how the world worked. Naturalism, one might say, was more than an aesthetic. It was also a state of mind. Much of this lecture series will be concerned with inquiring how this kind of art functioned and flourished. But it will also consider the opposition. For the two decades between 1880 and 1900 saw the burgeoning of modernism in France. These years saw Edgar Degas and Claude Monet working at impressively consistent levels of achievement, as well as the emergence of such talents as Odillon Redon, one of whose charcoals is on the left, Georges Seurat, Paul Gauguin, and not to mention that Dutch visitor Vincent van Gogh. When I bring these artists' work into play, I will do so by considering it in terms of the dominant naturalism, rather than simply on its own terms. The history of modernism tends to be exclusive and linear, privileging an elite to the exclusion of contemporaries and following a progressive sequence preordained by hindsight. My objective is to return all these kinds of painting to history, to their context under the Third Republic. In so doing, I shall try to treat the works I discuss equally. I have no intention of diminishing great innovative canvases by Seurat and his peers, there's Seurat's Baignard up there, nor do I seek to promote certain kinds of painting above their functional station. And I will be showing some fairly numbing canvases. Édouard Détaille's Funeral of Pasteur springs to mind. There's no question of revisionism here, then, but rather a respect for history and the contemporary mentalité. There are two central hypotheses. The first is the claim that I've already made, that naturalism was the dominant aesthetic in France between 1880 and 1900. Why and how this was, I shall explore in the early lectures. But one answer will be that it suited the ideology of the Third Republic. Naturalism in the visual arts, as in literature, was comprehensible. It dealt with matters of the moment, with common experience. Naturalist paintings, with their everyday subjects, were immediately legible. They required only vernacular culture to be brought to them to be understood. From these points of view, they were egalitarian. The Republic put great emphasis on being a progressive regime, supportive of modern thinking in sciences such as medicine and engineering. Naturalism was succoured by, shared, and sustained that mentalité of exactitude which characterised France's nascent technocracy. And naturalism's central concern, the description of actuality, could be made to serve the Republic's need to articulate and broadcast its ideological values, hence the value of a painting like Détaille's Funeral of Pasteur. If naturalist art to a considerable extent went hand in hand with republicanism, how might an artist who had no wish to either paint naturalistically or to ally with the republican consensus negotiate ways around that dominant aesthetic? The second hypothesis is in response to these questions. Naturalism might have the virtues that I've outlined, but it also had its flaws. In its worthiness, it might lack irony. And in its loyalty to mimesis, however flexible, it might lack style. To moderate and modify, or even entirely circumvent, its broad and encompassing reach, art seeking a pictorial and ideological independence would do well to seek style. Individual visual idioms of colour, touch and design that went beyond the reach of the hegemony of the actual and legible. Style will be a constant theme in these lectures. Exploring these two hypotheses will, I hope, lead us away from certain quite commonly held assumptions in present art history. One of these is the view, ironically held by modernists and revisionists alike, that naturalist painting of this period was content with surface description, derived such modernity as it mustered from a reliance on photography, and was in essence as conservative in the social values of its subjects as it was in the pictorial representation of them. Quite the contrary, I will argue. Naturalism allowed very diverse kinds of execution and representation, and was conscious in the range and diversity of its artifices, of which photography was only one. In addition, it was a deeply ideological aesthetic, often hand in glove with Republican rhetoric. The cumulative impact, year on year, of hundreds of descriptive canvases of contemporary French life, rural and urban, agricultural and industrial, septentrional and meridional, created a collective notion of national identity, substantially shaped to the priorities of the Republic. Therein lay naturalism's power to sustain its position as the dominant aesthetic. The second assumption is that the avant-gardism of a Seurat or a Gauguin was a reaction against entrenched academic art, stalled impressionism, or both. It could be argued that naturalist painting itself was a reaction to the academic system. After all, artists such as Jules Bastien Lepage and Friant complained about their academic tuition, while Alfred Rolle boasted of succeeding with negligible training. For such artists, naturalism was a means of introducing modernity into the established conventions of picture making, of making art useful for a wider society. As for the avant-garde, by the 1880s, the sclerotic traditions of academic painting, or the rather fragmented impressionism, were less at issue than the dominant naturalism. This had either to be adapted to serve individualistic, even subversive ends, or, better still, circumvented by innovative style. A third assumption concerns the importance of symbolism. It would be a fool who denied the importance of the symbolist aesthetic that emerged in the late 1880s as a critical counter to naturalism, an aesthetic that engendered and sustained the work of creative figures as significant as Odillon Redon, there's another of his charcoals on the left, and Maurice Denis, Paul Verlaine and Stéphane Mallarmé there on the right, must be respected. But symbolism was an aesthetic which, perhaps because of its very suggestive and even hermetic idioms, necessarily spoke for and to an elite public, whereas naturalism had a national ubiquity and audience. Some of these aspects I will not have time to discuss fully in these lectures and will do so in the book to come, but I must raise them now to indicate that I'm not ignoring them. Testing these hypotheses has wider methodological perspectives. One might say that these lectures are about building bridges. One of these is between history and the history of art. Over the next 8 weeks, I will place the emphasis first on works of art, with historical material in a more supportive role. In a sense, these lectures then are very different from my last book, The Troubled Republic, which began with historical problems in 1890s France, social degeneration, the crowd, church-state relations, and Franco-German rivalry, and brought the images to the problems. While I won't be bringing in a great deal of historical evidence and data into these lectures, there will be consistent historical underpinning to my arguments. The other bridge, one might say, is between Anglo-Saxon and French approaches to art history. British and Americans often tend to focus on modernism, considering work that doesn't fit that aesthetic's established patterns at best as mere context. The danger of such approach is that its values about what are good or interesting works, what is useful evidence, are preordained and not necessarily the values of the period. In recent years, the French have almost surrendered the modernist terrain to the Anglo-Saxons. However, French scholars are busily reviving the mainstream art of the Third Republic. Coincidentally, and to my advantage, there has been a glut of recent exhibitions. Friant, top left, and Morin in 2006, Bastien Lepage, Roll and Boulon in 2007, Charpentier, Prouvé and Baynard in 2008. We might ask why. Is it because France is currently at an impasse and looks back to images which show old certainties? A rural France? A French France? For we shouldn't forget that the art we admire perhaps tells us as much about who we are as the art we make. French scholars, however, tend to accumulate useful material about artists rather than interpret their work ideologically. My approach involves looking at a very wide range of pictures, from grand public decorations through easel paintings for exhibition and private ownership to posters, magazine illustrations and albums of lithographs. For reasons of time, I will deal chiefly with painting, occasionally touching on sculpture, but not the decorative arts. There will be some dinosaur bones. You might think redundant in this museum, but I promise you not. I will be looking at well-known works and artists, great names like Monet, Seurat and Toulouse-Lautrec, but from unexpected perspectives and in unusual contexts, trying to escape conventional categorizations. And I will assume a certain knowledge on my audience's part. So won't be stopping to define neo-impressionism, explain the Nabi, or outline Third Republic political history. This is not a survey course, but a series of arguments and propositions. I will also be analysing paintings by many artists celebrated in their own day, figures such as Lhermitte, Baynard, Carrière and Friant, and taking them seriously. I'll be introducing some striking and weird works too. If you want to see a painting of a woman having a blood transfusion from a goat, come next week. I intend to avoid dealing with these pictures with hindsight. My interest is in how it was for people then. By using a wide range of their pictures and their own words, one can better explore the mortality of the artists, critics, politicians and administrators of the period. In particular, I'm going to read naturalist pictures ideologically rather than as description or anecdote. And this brings historical processes into art history. Let me give you an example. Émile Friant's Oarsman of the Meurthe was exhibited at the Salon of 1887. At one level, it is a carefully contrived image of actuality, with its life-size figures caught in actions like pouring wine, removing a jacket, or passing a roast fowl. But there are more elusive readings. The title gives us a specific regional clue. Friant was from Nancy, on the Meurthe. This is a picture about pride in one's pays. It's also about vitality, about appetites worked up after a hard outing on the river, a positive image of young Frenchmen's physical prowess at a time of anxiety about national degeneration, the spread of alcoholism and venereal diseases. And the conviviality of the moment can also be taken as fraternité, deepened from genial anecdote into republican ideology, should that reading suit. Discover that the straw-hatted man on the left is Eugène Corbin, leading figure of the rowing club and scion of a Nancy department store-owning family, and Oarsman of the Meurthe, with its young patron and more ordinary citoyen, becomes a painting about cross-class harmony under the Republic. Such a picture should not be discarded as just a conventionally painted narrative. By the standards of 1887, it was modern in its actuality and in its inherent values. And, shown first in a private gallery at Nancy, and then seen by 500,000 at the Paris Salon, and many more across France when given a full page in the mass circulation Le Monde Illustré, a painting like this disseminated its message of well-being and collectivity very broadly. I need to explain some of my terms of reference. What do I mean by naturalism? Naturalisme was a word widely used in France during the second half of the 19th century. So was realisme, but I've preferred naturalism for several reasons. It was in more consistent usage in the 20 years that I'm exploring, whereas realism was declining as a term for discussion of the arts. Whether it was the conservative critic Henri Housset in 1882 worrying about the increasing prevalence of naturaliste et impressionniste works at the Salon, or the progressive administrator and critic Roger Marx noting in 1889 that le naturalisme est en faveur, to such an extent that even academic artists had begun peindre académiquement des réalités, naturalism was the key term in common aesthetic parlance. Naturalism was touted as a cultural movement by important figures such as the widely read novelist Émile Zola. It played across disciplines and media, and might be discussed in terms of theatre and sculpture, let alone painting or the novel. In addition, naturalism had echoes of the natural sciences, a link Zola, for one, was keen to promote, and this enhanced its impact and modernity. For, as a concept, naturalism meant more than merely the mimetic process of representing nature. Description was linked with exactitude. Take an example of an art historian writing in 1880 or so about a famous old master. Henri Havard praised Rembrandt's Night Watch, above all for that exactitude, that truth in the physiognomies and in the action which one identifies as naturalism. Exactitude was understood as a virtue, overlapping with scientific accuracy, precise evidence, pure knowledge, and moral truth, honesty, clear thinking, bon sens. Such values could easily become ideological, as we will see, in a republican mentalité which strove to assert its values of modernity and rationality. Naturalism may have been the dominant aesthetic term, but that's not to say that it was undisputed. The influential but reactionary theatre critic Francis Sassi railed that while we accept that some people have warts on their faces, we should not accept novelists and painters who get pleasure from contemplating warts. And in 1891, the journalist Jules Huret ran an important series of interviews in L'Echo de Paris, asking leading writers if naturalism was finished and whether symbolism had replaced it. But looking back from 1914, it was naturalism that had was taken to have dominated the previous generation's painting. As one critic dryly put it, the trend in the studios around 1885 was naturalism. People talked of the masterpieces to make with subjects like the Vanves-Malakoff railway station and the Batignolles-Clichy-Odillon bus. But the decoration of a new town hall was an occasion for a wedding banquet under the pergola or promenade of the bridal couple in the Parc Montsouris. The intellectual background to this aesthetic predominance was summed up by the academic Gabriel Monod in 1894. In a book on three major modern historians, Ernest de Renan, Hippolyte Taine, and Jules Michelet, Monod identified scientific realism, my naturalism, as the organic principle of French intellectual life in recent decades. This analysis of objective and demonstrable truth studied in concrete reality was, in Monod's view, a tendency so general, so deep, so truly organic that one finds the same passionate search for truth, for scientific realism, in every aspect of intellectual life, whether their authors know it or not. And he cited the paintings of Bastien Lepage and Ernest Meissonier, the novels of Zola and Guy de Maupassant, and the writings of Taine. Above all, for Monod, this current was cross-disciplinary, not only linking literature and the visual arts, but also the arts and sciences. For Paul Bourget used psychology in his novels, and Zola physiology and pathology in his. A key figure in this contemporary intellectual framework, which made naturalism the basis of modern thought, was Hippolyte Taine, seen here in a portrait by Léon Bonnat, professor of the history of art at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris since 1864. Taine had put forward his ideas in books such as Philosophie de l'Art of 1865. Above all, he believed in the deterministic principle that artistic production was shaped by historical and cultural circumstances, that race, moment, et milieu made a work of art look as it did. This concept was so prevalent as a means of judging and justifying naturalist paintings that it was consistently alluded to by contemporary writers, with no necessary citation of Taine. Thus, when the museum curator Léonce Bénédict summed up Alfred Rolle's work, it was as exclusively of his time, of his country, and of his milieu. Equally, arguing that an artist did not live up to Taine's formula was a way of distancing his work from naturalism, as the symbolist writer Georges Rodenbach did when he saw Eugène Carrière's work as voluntarily neglecting, disdaining what is to do with race, period, or class. Another prominent figure in the shaping of this naturalist mentalité, named in Monod's schema, was the novelist Émile Zola. Between 1870 and 1893, Zola produced the 20 novels of the Rougon-Macquart series, their ideas on heredity and determinism influenced by Taine. Zola also made theoretical contributions, helping to define naturalism's intellectual scope. His Le Roman Expérimental, published in 1880, was a manifesto for literary naturalism, vaunting writing that would describe and analyse absolutely any aspect of modern experience. Significantly, there was a section entitled La République et la Littérature, in which Zola proclaimed his own republicanism and then insisted, La République sera naturaliste ou il ne sera pas. The Republic will be naturalist or it won't happen, won't exist. This was a play on the statement by Adolphe Thiers, the first president of the Third Republic, that the Republic will be conservative or it won't exist. Zola's argument was that naturalism is a republican literature, given that the Republic was based on a democratic decision itself made after factual analysis of the nation's needs. He saw the Republic emerging from the same process of scrupulous observation of material reality as manifested by his novels or the medicine of the late Claude Bernard, with whose experimental pathology he also sought to draw parallels. Zola defined naturalism as the analytical and experimental method, modern inquiry based on facts and human documents. Failure to capitalize on the modernity of naturalist method was to fail to be truly modern. Yet Zola recognized that the description and analysis of the material world as a creative rather than scientific act needed to allow flexibility. Not everyone responds and sees in the same way. So his next theoretical text, Les Romanciers Naturalistes of 1881, acknowledged that Zola's Médon group of naturalist writers, including Maupassant and Huysmans, had personal literary styles within their collective naturalist aesthetic. And he said the same of painters. These texts by Zola are significant. They help define naturalism, moderating its core belief in close descriptive analysis with generosity towards personal means of expression, stressing the aesthetic's interdisciplinarity, its reach encompassing literature and the visual arts, its mentalité shared with the sciences. These were all terms with which Monod's academic survey would agree a decade and a half later. Finally, it is no coincidence that Le Roman Expérimental was published in 1880, as Republican politics really got into gear, because for Zola, with his play on Thiers' admonition about the Republic's future, naturalism was inescapably ideological. Nor should we doubt Zola's intellectual impact within the world of the visual arts. The novelist may have written very little art criticism during the 1880s and 90s, but his earlier naturalist definition of a work of art, La nature vue à travers un temporaire mont, was constantly quoted, evoked, and impugned. To give just two examples, when Octave Mirbeau praised Raffaelli's At the Founders, there on the left in 1886, as nature seen by a masculine temperament, He was using a naturalist dictum for a naturalist picture. Whereas when in 1892 Maurice Denis found Louis Anquetin's recent work re-engaging with the theory of nature seen through a temperament, the committed symbolist Denis was somewhat disappointed by what he saw as this recidivist lapse. The common currency of that definition is but one instance of the hegemony of that cultural and intellectual agenda, whether you call it Zola's naturalism, Taine's positivist determinism, Monod's scientific realism. Naturalist painting emerged from it, belonged within it, and contributed to it, giving visual and broadcastable form to the Republic's dominant mentalité. What of the Third Republic itself? I've got no time to go into detail about the policies, manoeuvrings, and personalities of 20 years of complex pictorial activity, but let's build an armature at least. The Third Republic was founded on the 4th of September 1870, in the wake of military defeat at the hands of the invading German armies and the subsequent collapse of the Second Empire. However, the 1870s was a decade of false starts and conservative reaction. It wasn't until the elections of January 1879 that a politically authentic republic was in place, with a majority in both the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, and a genuine republican, Jules Grévy, seen there painted by Bonnat in 1880, as president. This is where I begin. The 1870s had at least shown republicans clearly who their enemies were and the extent of the work necessary to defeat them. In broad terms, the Republican project was to create a civic religion, using the Republic to give moral unity to France. Republicans' beacon principles, liberty, equality, fraternity, were values drawn from Enlightenment thought and tempered in the fire of the French Revolution. A century on, it was time to put them in place. The Republic drew value from this inheritance, and the visual arts were only one medium used to validate it. For example, at the Exposition Universelle of 1889, a team of painters led by Gervex and Alfred Stevens painted the giant Panorama du Siècle. Those are only some fragments of it. A pictorial survey of the great and good of the past century. Its central section at the top there was comprised of an arch surmounting a monument to the glory of France, and behind it four niches with statues of Enlightenment philosophes. This insistence on historical continuity was echoed in Camille Lefebvre's 1895 sculpture of the Republic for the Mairie of Issy-les-Moulineaux. Here, the figures of liberty, equality, and fraternity, as they reach down towards Marianne, the symbol of the Republic, are each given a date, which you might be able to see on the carving, but the photograph was taken by me, so it's not very good. And the dates are there, 1789, 1830, 1848, registering revolutions in French society and the chronological progression towards the realization of present republicanism. Liberté, égalité, and fraternité are political values, standing for and against. Under the early Third Republic, they stood against the past. Liberty from the autocratic rule of monarch or emperor, from religious belief or superstition, from control by the Catholic Church and the curé. Equality rather than the class hierarchy of aristocrats and notables. They also stood for the present and future, for liberty of thought and expression, of political association, equality between the couches sociales, fraternity as a means of building a unified nation. For, as Graham Robb has recently reminded us, France was a very diverse country. Language, social customs, food, building materials, agricultural practices all differed from region to region across the Hexagone. France was in an analogous position to two neighbouring countries which had recently unified politically, Germany and Italy, in that it still, in the Republican scheme, needed to cohere into a single nation. Republicanism was therefore a political ideology with a job to do. nation-building, if that term hasn't been recently somewhat debased. This necessitated the promotion of the collective. In March 1882, Ernest Renan, seen here again in a portrait by Bonnard, I will be showing you other pictures than portraits by Bonnard, I can assure you. In March 1882, Ernest Renan gave a famous lecture at the Sorbonne, What is a Nation? His conclusion? A great aggregation of men, healthy of spirit and warm of heart, creates a moral consciousness that is called a nation. The Republic sought to shape that consciousness to its own principles, to unite that aggregation under the banner of fraternity. That process was identified with modernity, for the progressive and scientific principles inherited from the Enlightenment led ever forward. The pictures that I'm going to explore in these lectures, pictures that went on show in Paris and other cities, that were photographed and reproduced in magazines, contributed by the process of accretion to this consciousness. Whether a landscape of Antibes by Claude Monet or of the Vosges by Louis Francais, a peasant scene by Léon Lhermitte or Camille Pissarro, a Parisian suburb by Luigi Loire or Jean-François Raffaelli, the cumulative impact of descriptive canvases in such a climate was a contribution to the constant definition of the moral consciousness of nationhood that Renan had identified. Broadly speaking, Republicans wanted a conservative regime. Although there was universal manhood suffrage, a radical constitutional situation in contemporary Europe, the actively political classes sought stability and consensus to protect the elites and their property. Social reform tended to be a limited objective. There were, of course, shifting political patterns during the two decades with which I'll be dealing. During the 1880s, Republicans' chief opponent was the church. Politicians determined to wrest influence on the nation's young from the church, the better to mould a republican future, and they pursued anti-clerical policies, particularly in education. The steady process of laicization involved the gradual removal of Catholic influence in schools, beginning with the expulsion of the Jesuits in 1880, as well as other social reforms, such as the liberalisation of the divorce law in 1884. But by the 1890s, relations between church and state had become less confrontational. In the 90s, it was increasingly the political left, especially the growing threat of socialism, as well as the resurgent right, which troubled the majority Republican centre. Of course, the broad front of republicanism itself was very diverse. There were many strains, opportunist, radical, solitarist, and so on, jostling and regrouping in often short-lived administrations. Again, there were different commitments to the Republic in different regions, and the Catholic right was strong in Brittany and the North, for example. Different interests and constituencies could be truculent and might need to be addressed in different ways to suit their different demands. What, you will be asking, was the place of the visual arts in this? Well, that's one of the main questions that I'll be addressing in this series, when I can assure you, be talking more about pictures. But I want to close this introductory lecture by returning to painting. If republicanism, liberty, equality, fraternity, was to become a civic religion, it needed to be taught. So education, the instilling of republican values across France to create that broad ideological consensus, was a crucial political mechanism. The introduction to the official publication of the great Exposition Universelle, held in 1889, right at the middle of my period, made this crystal clear. We will show to our sons what their fathers have done in a century, through the progress of education, the love of work, and respect for liberty. Education meant more than schooling. It meant the subtle and constant indoctrination of all citizens with republican values. This was addressed particularly at men, who had the vote in France's new democracy. It was no coincidence that the official rhetoric I've just quoted talked of fathers and sons, and I will return to virility in later lectures. This discrete process of propagandizing the electorate involved a wide variety of methods, among them the visual arts. Almost throughout this period, there was a Ministry of Public Instruction and Fine Arts, an indication of how the Republic understood art as an ideological tool. Jules Ferry, a leading politician in the 1880s, was quite frank about this in a speech of April 1881. "For a society like ours, a lively democracy, art, messieurs, is above all and before all a major means of popular education. What politicians required, civil servants delivered." In an 1895 speech, the senior functionary Gustave Larrumet insisted that "modern democracy gives art a public role, above all through its museums, which are a form of instruction." To address its many constituencies and satisfy diverse interests, the state had to acknowledge different forms of art and embrace an eclectic range of styles. I don't want to be doctrinaire in my lectures and assume that naturalism was the dominant aesthetic in competition with no stylistic alternatives. Undoubtedly, forms of classicism, notably that of Puvis de Chavannes, seen there on the left, or the neo-baroque of artists such as Léon Bonnat on the right, had a substantial impact in grand public painting, for example. This eclecticism became a problem with big public commissions such as the Hôtel de Ville in Paris and the Capitole in Toulouse, where many different interests had to be admitted, leading to a chaos of styles. But I think that it is too easy to conclude, with Pierre Weiss, that the Republic's liberal embrace of eclectic styles is the main story. Undoubtedly, both expediency and Republican egalitarianism encouraged leading administrators such as Larrumet and Jules Castagnieret to recognise diverse kinds of work and in so doing accept a degree of laissez-faire eclecticism. But within that surface liberalism was a naturalist drive. Antonin Proust, seen here in a bust by Rodin, Minister of Culture in Gambetta's short-lived government and pivotal figure at the 1889 Exposition Universelle, explained that while he could find merit in allegories and historical subjects, "I confess that I have a marked predilection for the representation of something seen." Those on the left were also clear. On the committee charged with commissioning decorations for the reconstructed Paris Hôtel de Ville, councillors such as the socialist Édouard Vaillant and former communard Léon Donat demanded real and true images of the political, economic and social life of the everyday people of Paris. One suspects that such a position was common across much of the Republican spectrum. A primary means by which the state could promote its values and manipulate mentalité via the fine arts were, inevitably, committees. The Ministry of Public Instruction and Fine Arts set up Le Comité des Travaux d'Art in February 1882, its remit to vet public commissions and buy works for the state collections. Effectively, this meant that the state bought art that suited it. Take its purchases from the Salon of 1889. One was Lhermitte's portrait of the great pathologist Claude Bernard, Zola's inspiration, a picture intended for the Académie de Médecine at the new Sorbonne, an exemplary image of the scientific progress vaunted by the Republic. Another was Jean-Paul Laurens's Men of the Holy Office, a typical naturalistic historical reconstruction of a scene of the Inquisition. Destined for the Élysée Palace, it would have served as a reminder to the president of the autocratic illiberalism of the church, if he needed such a reminder. In addition, there were over a dozen landscapes, among them Paul Saïn's Near Avignon. These landscapes represented sites all over France, from Flanders to Provence, the Loire to the Champagne. On exhibition at the Salon, they would have given visitors a descriptive reminder of the nation's geographical diversity. distributed to provincial museums and town halls, they would have satisfied this or that regional préfet, député or maire, consolidating the Republic's status through the visual arts. What kind of art suited the Republican project? This is another question which I'll explore in much greater detail in the next two lectures. But let me give you some quick-fire answers, because they support my case that the naturalist aesthetic had a strong ideological foundation. First, republicanism favoured art which was democratic and egalitarian. Some examples. Alfred Rohl submitted an informal sequence of paintings to the salons of the 1880s and 1890s of various social types, usually of the lower classes. Among these were Ruby, cement worker, at the 1884 salon, and Manda Lametrie, farmer's wife, purchased from the state from the 1888 salon. Life-size and giving names and métier, these were portraits of égalité, ordinary citizens given the pictorial status of a grandee. The city of Paris bought Jules Dallou's large high-relief Fraternité from the 1883 salon, intending it for a grand room in the reconstructed Hôtel de Ville. Dallou, like Rohl, a committed republican, protested that he would rather it were mounted in a public garden, visible to the many, not just the few. This egalitarianism had other visual manifestations. Thus, when his great tower was completed in spring 1889, Gustave Eiffel had the names of the 199 workers who had been employed on its construction from start to finish painted prominently on a girder. A second republican requirement was legibility. So when, in 1888, Alfred Brontë submitted his preliminary sketch there for universal suffrage, a subject central to republican ideology, for the Salle du Conseil at the Mairie of Lille in the Parisian suburbs, he was required to make changes for the final decoration. He had to reverse the composition, placing registration on the left and voting on the right, so the public picture read in a logical sequence. But Brontë had already established in his sketch that much of what was expected was easily legible. Voters from across the couche sociale, the quasi-religious act of casting the vote. A third desideratum was that art should be exact and scientific. In other words, that the fine arts should comply with the cultural mentalité of Zola's naturalism or Monod's scientific realism. There's time for one example. That fascination with exactitude was not restricted to the contemporary. At the Salon of 1880, Jean-Joseph Wiertz exhibited Macha Assassinated, 13th of July 1793, 8 o'clock in the evening, which, as a defining moment of the revolution, was purchased by the state. The painting is highly dramatized in the gestures of its life-size figures, with the scene set back from the spectator as if on stage. But that theatricality is tempered by the specificity of texture, costume, and accessory, right down to the exact number 678 of the news sheet L'Ami du Peuple tipping into Marat's bath. On its frame was a cartouche with a detailed 18th century account of the murder, identifying figures such as Marat's common law wife, Chaumette. Thus, Wiertz's canvas is as accurate in documentary terms as it is immediate in dramatic. On the 8th of July 1886, the Musée Grévin purchased the actual tub in which Marat was seated when Charlotte Corday knifed him. The Waxwork Museum used it in a reconstruction of the event, which opened in autumn 1886 and was loosely derived from Wiertz's composition. The Musée Grévin was as determined to advocate its authenticity as Wiertz. Its catalogue devoted 5 pages to describing Marat's death, explaining how the musée had traced his actual bathtub and even reprinting the deed of sale. In both grand exhibition painting and the popular culture of the waxwork, exactitude and the document were understood to be central to validating visual representation, in presenting the wide public with reliable information, in promoting knowledge appropriate to the Republican project. In the next two lectures, I'll explore how naturalist painting functioned, how it might be imbued with Republican rhetoric, and how it might be read. The aim is to do more than prove that naturalism was the dominant aesthetic in France during the 1880s and 90s. It's to demonstrate that naturalist painting's dominance was due to the way the image of the world it offered was consistent with, and indeed contributed massively to the formation of, a consensus. That consensus gravitated around several overlapping mentalités: the broad spectrum of Republican ideology, a shared grasp of social, national, and civic values, and a sense of what was modern. All this is encapsulated overtly in a painting such as Jean Barrault's La Marseillaise, with its carefully staged communal republicanism, and rather more suggestively in Friant's Political Discussion of 1890, scrupulously representing the penetration of literacy and liberty of debate among the provincial petits gens. These mentalités were those of the dominant classes, and imagery in a public mural decoration, an exhibition painting or magazine illustration served to disseminate them. But what I want to do more in these lectures than explore this with you, I want to do more in these lectures than explore this with you. After all, what comes down from above can attract ridicule. So how did caricature play on that dominant naturalism? And what comes up from below can be hard to trace. So what evidence can we find of art tempered not by the bourgeois, but by the populaire? But these propositions and speculations lead towards a much larger issue. This concerns the status of avant-garde painting. We understand the 1880s and 90s in France as the crucible of modernist art, and I, for one, am not going to deny the value or importance of Degas or Monet, Seurat or Gauguin, all of whom will feature in later lectures. But if we revalue naturalism, acknowledge its aesthetic centrality, register its embodiment of what most contemporaries considered as modern in both subject and style, do we not need to recalibrate our understanding of the avant-garde? Might we not need to consider avant-gardism less as heroic pioneering of new forms of expression, and more as a modification of, a deliberately negotiated repudiation of, perhaps even an eventual submission to, that dominant naturalism? Let's see.